Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group, Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com, or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
Simplified. Well, good morning, Northwest. This is Chuck Price, President of Price Financial Group Wealth Management, and in studio with me is Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm.
Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning, Carl. And we're waiting to connect with our special guest, Harry Dent, the economist and author of a new book called The Demographic Cliff, How to Survive and Prosper During the Great Deflation of 2014 to 2019. And Harry Dent is also the author of a newsletter that you can get. And actually, I guess it comes about every day. Emails, I get them like crazy. And you can subscribe to that free. It's called Survive and Prosper. And you can sign up at www.harrydent.com. I do want to give the toll-free number for you people in the outlying areas. We do have a number, 1-800-990-0750. That's 800-990-0750. And for local callers, it's 503-417-0750. 503-417-7626. And we've got Harry Dent joining us here from Tampa, Florida. Harry, are you there?
Yes.
Yeah, how's the weather in Tampa?
It's good. It's a little cooler than usual, but we've had it much easier than a lot of the country this winter, so we're not complaining.
Yeah, we really have been kind of fortunate, too. We've had a little bit of bad weather, but not much, and this weekend's been great. Well, listen, we're going to get right into it. I just got through giving a promo about your new book and about how people need to go on Amazon and can order it, or they can also go on my website and order it. And The Demographic Cliff, How to Survive and Prosper During the Great Deflation of 2014-2019. And there's a lot of things going on in the marketplace, and I'm amazed every day when I hear the people on the news, whether it's Fox Business or CNBC, because I tend to watch both, how much they say that depending on what's going on around the world, one day it's because a plane's missing, the market's having a tough day or having a good day, or we may be going to war is going to cause another problem. But last week, the Dow Jones dropped about 400 points.
Yeah, but it's amazing with all that's going on, especially the Russian-Ukraine thing, that the market didn't react more. And it shows to me how bubbly this market is. I mean, here Russia kind of invades Crimea. The markets go down for one day. Then the next day, with a little backing off of Putin, even though he's already won that war, they're up to new highs. It's like this market, outside of bad news, just goes up, 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 because the government's feeding it with money. This QE goes into the financial institutions. It's not being lent out and recirculated into the economy. It's just being invested and often at high leverage, and it's just got to go somewhere. And since stocks are holding up the best, commodities have already tanked, and that's right in line with our 30-year commodity cycle we've been predicting for years. In emerging countries doing less well, and in bonds doing less well, hey, the money keeps going into the stock market. So this is what I call an artificial bubble. The bubbles we had, and I was the biggest predictor of the 90s bubble before it happened in the U.S. and Europe, was driven by the strongest demographics we've seen in history of baby boom spending, and it was driven by the Internet and key technologies moving mainstream, much like car, automobiles and electricity and phones did in the early 1900s and the roaring 20s. So that was a fundamental bubble. And, of course, when something, the economy gets that good, investors will always overdo it and value stocks too high, and then you get a crash. But this is totally an artificial bubble without QE, we were going into a Great Depression, a major debt deleveraging, and the government's just stopped that. Well, 5 years later, you know, we've got $4 to $5 trillion more debt than we had at the top of the last debt bubble, which is the greatest in history. And the demographic trends, the point of this book is to show that the demographic trends get worse in the United States in the year ahead. Germany starts to go off a cliff steeper in spending than Japan did in the 90s, and we were the only ones to see the fall of Japan with simple demographic indicators. And more countries keep seeing baby boom generations decline in their spending or get worse. So the demographic trends are only going to get worse in the next several years, and governments think, oh, if we can just stimulate long enough, we'll get back to normal. That is such a misunderstanding of the economy. It's unforgivable for economists to be so clueless about what actually drives our economy and why we're in this mess, record high debt levels, and baby boom declines in spending around the developed world, and what you can do about it. And you can't just keep pumping up debt to fight this crisis. You can't fight debt with more debt, and you can't just artificially keep a bubble going, because the problem with the Fed is not that they're going to ignite high inflation. That already hasn't happened. The problem with the Fed is they're creating even bigger bubbles, and bubbles always burst. And so when this next bubble bursts, and I think it's going to start to burst in a matter of months, then the wealth effect disappears dramatically, and we go back into decline, and then this QE basically disappears.
Well, you don't think there's any chance that if we go into that tailspin, they're not going to print, just try to throw more money at it?
Yeah, no, I think they will. I think it won't do a lot of good. What we show is that, you know, first of all, it's going to take a number of months for the Fed to determine, hey, was the slowdown in the fourth and first quarter due to weather, or was it more a natural slowdown, as our cycle suggests? By time then, we could already be in a recession, and then it's kind of harder to turn it around. But the thing I keep preaching, Chuck, to people is that it's going to be external factors. We basically triggered the last global financial crisis with our subprime crisis, and that was focused in just four states: California, Nevada, Arizona, and Florida. This time, the big trigger is going to be China. China's got the biggest overbuilding bubble by governments in history, the greatest real estate bubble when you look at valuations, more like 30 times income in their major cities, I mean, versus 10 times in like Sydney or Melbourne or Vancouver or California at the top of our bubble, or 15 times in London. I mean, it's just a massive bubble. We're saying this is going to burst, and when it does, Chinese wealth is so tied into real estate. They save massively more than we do, and they put it massively more into real estate. They don't invest in stocks and bonds as much. So that is when that bubble blows, our QE is not going to be able to do anything to deal with that. So that's where the Fed gets checkmated.
You know, there's a massive number of, of course, Japanese have been buying in Hawaii forever, and the Chinese are buying over there, and they're also now buying in our mainland.
Yes. They are buying California heavily, New York, Australia, New Zealand, Singapore. They are keeping bubbles going up, and London. They like English-speaking places where they can leave, and this is another factor that worries me. The richest people in China are getting the hell out of Dodge. They see a bubble there. They think when it bursts, the government's going to come after their wealth, so they're getting out ahead of time. They want a place where they can get their kids in English-speaking schools, and that's these places. So they're keeping the bubbles going in a lot of these cities, the revival in California, the continued bubbles in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, London. They're keeping it going. It is foreign buying. 70% of buying in London is foreign, and about 50% in Manhattan, New York. And I estimate, when I was in Australia recently, that, you know, 40 to 50% of the buying in their key cities is foreign buying. Now when that Chinese wealth evaporates, like happened to the Japanese in the late and early 90s when their real estate and stock bubbles burst, then these Chinese are suddenly going to have to stop buying, suddenly going to have to sell their foreign real estate to shore up their domestic real estate. I am estimating, and Chuck, this is a serious estimate, because bubbles erase themselves. China's real estate in cities like Beijing and Shanghai have to go down 80 to 85%. And that's, I mean, they've gone up 5 to 6 times since early 2000s when this bubble started around the world. So that is just massive. And nobody thinks that's possible. I think it's inevitable.
Say, Harry, you know, with all the news about the Russians, I was just, I hate to ask almost, but how are they positioned when you know, the big bubbles burst? I mean, their economy is sort of different than ours, at least at this time.
Yeah. You know, their stock market and their best industries are commodity exporters, especially energy and things like that. And that's what this whole worry is about. I mean, Europe doesn't want Russia taking over Crimea and then eventually maybe Ukraine. But they also don't want Russia to cut off their natural gas and oil supplies to Europe. So that's kind of the dilemma there. But that is also Russia's weakness. Russia has terrible demographic trends, just like Southern and Central Europe and East Asia and ahead. That's not good for Russia. And most important, we have a very consistent 29 to 30 year commodity cycle that has peaked between 2008 and 11 and kind of two different peaks and points down into around 2023. If commodity prices keep going down, it's already hurting emerging countries. Their stocks are 25% off their tops on average. It's hurting Russia, and it will hurt Russia more. So Russia does not have a good future, but it's all the more incentive, if that's the case, for Russia to annex back parts of the Soviet Union that they lost. I mean, you know, if they're going to keep having an economic decline, countries that go into economic decline, like Germany in the 30s, that's an incentive to go to war. So it makes Russia a more dangerous place. But Russia is just going to lose economic power over the next couple decades. I'm clear on that.
Well, hopefully war isn't an option. That could be bad all the way around. But
yeah, hopefully it's not.
Yeah, you know, one other thing, too, that I kind of want to mention, because at your Irrational Summit last October, you guys talked about on your panel about possibly at some time in the future, because everybody's talking about this, at some time in the future the government might attack Roth IRAs. And the president gave a proposed budget here, and one of the things he has done has kind of went right at the Roth IRA in that he wants to require them to take RMDs, which, of course, they haven't had to, and he also wants to do away with the stretch IRA, Roth IRA option.
Well, you know, the bigger issue I see is that, you know, our government deficits are only going to get worse. I mean, not just because of a declining economy that we're projecting when most people are thinking we're going back to normal, which I can guarantee you we're not from what we're looking at, but is that our entitlements are just off the charts. I mean, we've got a smaller groups of young people in a declining economy supposed to support huge numbers of baby boomers who are going to be retiring on average for over two decades. I mean, they're going to be retiring that long, and they're going to be retiring in increasing numbers into the next decade and a half, and then being in retirement two decades after that. I mean, this is like three or four decades of endless deficits. We're going to have to restructure entitlements. We're going to have to deal with a lot of things. And the question is, how does government do this? Do they force people to, you know, invest their private funds and 401k and all these IRAs and stuff in treasury bonds to hold them up and support all their deficits? You know, are they going to tax affluent people higher? And that's almost a certainty. And, you know, and what else are they going to do? Because they're going to be put in a desperate situation. What we need to do is force the government to say, look, I mean, we need to all recognize you can't work for 42 years on average and then retire for 21 on average, and that's what the life expectancy say. It's just not possible, even if the next generation were as large or larger, but it's not. It's smaller, and it's even smaller in many countries like Japan, and Germany has no echo boom. It's just declining trends for decades. So we're going to have to deal with our deficits, and we're going to particularly have to deal with entitlements. And in the best way is to work longer and say, hey, we need to transition to be retiring at 75, not 62 to 65, and we could do that over the next 10 to 20 years. But we're going to have to do this. Otherwise, our workforce is going to shrink, and it's going to shrink even more in other countries. Germany's already, since it's the second fastest aging country in the world after Japan, already raised their retirement age from 65 to 67. Well, they need to go to 75, and then still they're going to have slowing of workforce down the road, but at least that would keep them from slowing for another decade or two. So we got some real big realities ahead, And all I can see is that we're going to have a crisis to even come to reality about it, because nobody's even close. Paul Ryan's plan to restructure the budget deficit entitlement wasn't even in the ballpark of what would be necessary with the scenario we see ahead. So that's politically unacceptable. So it's going to take a crisis, unfortunately. And that's why I tell investors, look, get out of the way. Protect your assets. Do not believe all these people, including Warren Buffett, saying this is not a bubble, everything's okay, the government's doing the right things. They are not doing the right things. They are not dealing with debt. They're not dealing with entitlements. And they're just pushing this crisis down the road. And when it does hit, largely likely because an external factor like Germany falling off the cliff or China blowing up in their bubble, those two things are something that the U.S. government can't control and deal with QE. So this is not going to last much longer, from my estimate. So we're seeing stocks peaking probably by early May, roughly. You know, they don't look like they're quite ready to peak yet. But people need to basically protect your gains, preserve your capital, wait for the next crash. The next crash can only be bigger than the last one. My estimate is the Dow goes to 17,000 roughly and then down to 6,000 or a little lower in the next 2 to 3 years. That is not something you want to sit through.
Yeah, that's certainly something that we've been talking to our clients about, that cash is king. And if you have your money available, there's even in a bad market or a bad recession or almost depression, there's a lot of great opportunities that you can get to and write it back up. So there, if you got the money.
It's going to be a sale on financial assets, the greatest sale on financial assets of our lifetime. If you look at it that way, being in safer investments and waiting for that to happen, I mean, yeah, what if you could buy stocks at 30 cents on the dollar or beachfront property at 20, 30, 40 cents on the dollar for your dream vacation home or anything else, or gold at $250 to $400 an ounce, I mean, long term. That's the opportunity, and that's how people made fortunes in the 1930s. There were more millionaires per capita through entrepreneurial activity and people like Joseph Kennedy that stepped out of the bubble and rebought at 10, 20, 30 cents on the dollar. I was just in Australia, staying at Hamilton Island, one of the nicest island probably in Australia, at the nicest resort, Qualia, and I learned that a billionaire had bought that island for $150 million in the 2000-2002 crisis when it went into bankruptcy. He bought it for $150 million. The airport was worth more than that, and it's got to be a $2.5 to $3 billion island today. I estimate he bought that back then at about 10 cents on the dollar. Wow. Now, that's how you make a lot of money in a downturn.
Yeah, and I think those opportunities are coming. I've been telling my clients for some time, I believe the greatest buying opportunity in our lifetime is coming, particularly in real estate, because I think real estate is going to particularly get crippled.
Yes. I mean, people think the real estate crash is over. We get, again, and I go through this in Chapter 5 of the book so people can see it. I mean, in Australia, I spent hours on this because I had an audience for 3 days and about 6 hours in presentations. I said, look at every bubble in history, real estate, stocks, commodities, tulips, anything. They all go exponential at some point. They all crash. And when they crash, 95% of the time, they go back at least to where the bubble started. And most of that time, it goes down a little bit lower. I mean, real estate needs to go down 55 to 65% from its top in early 2006. And we predicted that top in late 2005 in my newsletter. We saw that coming. Nobody other than Robert Shiller saw that coming. Everybody says real estate can never go down. I'm like, no, this is a bubble. Real estate, now that it's bounced, has got at least 40% downside. And, of course, in the higher-priced places from New York to San Francisco, to South Beach and Miami and stuff, it's going to go down more than that. So, yeah, there's going to be another real estate downturn, at least as large as the one before, and I think larger. So, yeah, real estate is probably the greatest opportunity, especially for aging baby boomers that want that dream retirement home or vacation home. On a ski slope or on a great beach area or something. Those things bubble up the most, and then they come down the most. So that's where I'd say the real opportunity is going to be.
Yeah, I know that on the news, you watch the business news, but I had a article here Mr. Klarman, I don't know if you, I'm sure you know who he is, but anyway, he made a statement that any year in which the S&P jumps 32%, and the NASDAQ 40%, while corporate earnings barely increase, should not be a cause for concern, not for further exuberance. In other words, get out of the market because everything is overpriced.
Yeah, exactly. Anybody with half a brain, Chuck, from Ned Davis to anybody, you know, George Soros, anybody's expecting a 20 to 30% correction this year just because we had such a run. And up until 2013, the stock market was growing with earnings. Now, these earnings are artificial because about 30, 40% of this is coming just from stock buybacks, which companies can only do with the ultra-low short-term interest rates the government has pushed below market values. And another big chunk is coming just from lower borrowing costs for corporations. I mean, it's gone down dramatically. So about 60, 70% of that increase was artificial. But they were at least correlating with earnings. But he's right. In the last year plus, stocks have been going up much faster than earnings. That's telling you that a bubble's getting ready to peak. The stocks are now getting out of whack. And people say, oh, it's only 17 times price earnings ratios. If you adjust, as Robert Shiller does, for cyclicality in earnings, which is extreme, and take the average of the last 10 years of earnings to measure versus price, then we are at like 27 times, and this is where most bubbles or bull markets have peaked in the past. So we are more overvalued than the stock market looks, because these earnings are already decelerating, and they're not going to be able to sustain this pace. So looking at the price of stocks versus last year or this year's earnings is not a good measure of overvaluation, because earnings are so bubbly, and they are slowing down. Like you said, there's been a minor increase in earnings in the last year and a huge increase in stock prices. Oops. Yeah, that is not when you buy stocks.
Yeah, absolutely. It's pretty easy to show a great run-up when you take it at the bottom of the pit and then run it up from there. But if you go from a straight line to one of the high, it's not been a great growth for stocks.
My biggest thing, Chuck, again, is that, I mean, we've seen bubbles. I mean, we're in a bubbly period. Bubbles only come once in a lifetime, like the roaring 20s and the 90s and 2000s. And we've seen everything bubble up now, and stocks now three times in a row. We're in a bubbly time, but this is an artificial bubble, which makes it even more dangerous. At least the 90s bubble especially had the strongest fundamental trends in our lifetimes. And we called that in the great boom ahead in our Power to Predict back in the late 80s or 90s. We said the 90s is going to be the strongest decade in history for U.S. and Europe, while Japan crashes because they have opposite demographic trends and technology trends. And so those were at least deserved. They just got overdone. And then when things crashed into 2002, we said, hey, no, this boom is not over yet. But it was over in 2007. The baby boomers, we've been predicting for 20 years, would peak right around late 2007, and we'd go into a 12 to 14-year downturn, just like we predicted for Japan in late 89. And the technologies had basically 90% penetrated. Internet, broadband, PCs, cell phones. So the best of the technology revolution was over. So the trends are not going to be good for the next decade or so. And that's the case. And then what are governments doing? They're just fighting it with trillions and trillions of dollars of QE. It's just like taking more and more of a drug, or it's like taking crack or cocaine to keep from coming down and stay high. It's not a good policy. And the fact that economists and Warren Buffett and people like this and political officials think this is an okay policy is just astounding to me. This is going to look like total idiocy and insanity in history.
You know, what I don't understand is, I understand where Warren Buffett, because he's on the inside, and he stands to gain from whatever they do anyway.
But yeah, and now he's the U.S. government's cheerleader. They're using him. I think
exactly.
They drugged him and put a chip in his head.
Yeah, especially when they bailed him out when the crisis came and they saved him about $5 billion, which
he really needs bad.
I mean, yeah.
His deal with Goldman Sachs getting the top 10%, Goldman Sachs could go totally bankrupt and he'd still get his money back because they have some assets. So he got a deal you couldn't lose money on by stepping in. So, yeah, he got a very favorable deal.
Well, look at the deal he got with, I call him Tank America, with Bank America.
Yeah.
The $5 billion in preferred stock at 6% when the market was down, and he bought it, and it was convertible to stock, and he did that when the stock was like $3 a share. He made about $5 billion off of it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And couldn't lose. So for him to say, I'm investing Yeah, maybe very long term, but to tell the American public it's okay to buy stocks here, he is going to lose his reputation on this because people trust him. He's the greatest investment manager probably in history. He deserves that success. He is great, but he doesn't know crap about the economy. And he used to say, I don't even try to predict the economy. I don't care about the economy. I just buy really good long-term brands when they're at good value. I don't look at the economy, and I invest very long-term. And that is successful, and that is a great way to do it. And he's got the guts and foresight to do that. But this is not what the average citizen does. And he's basically saying, I believe in the U.S. economy. I believe in the U.S. government and what they're doing. And it's okay to come in and buy stocks here at the top of this bubble. That is incredibly short-sighted and irresponsible. And I think his reputation a decade from now is going to suffer from that.
Well, when you have $45 billion, you can afford to make some mistakes.
But he's not a guy that spends all his money. He's going to give it all away. He cares, and he should care about his reputation. People love him and trust him. He's an everyday American that with just sound, simple principles, no high technology, no manipulation, has made a fortune and done it consistently over time. He is the American dream, and now he's out there telling people, hey, U.S. government's doing the right thing. What do you mean? Creating trillions of dollars out of thin air and covering up a financial crisis is doing the right thing? A 10-year-old could figure this out.
Well, what amazes me is, why isn't any politician standing up and saying, you guys are spending our grandchildren and our children into bankruptcy, and this is going to be a long-term bailout?
A lot of Republicans are. That is what they're saying. And I don't agree with the Tea Party on a lot of things, mostly social policies. But I do agree this debt thing is the biggest debt bubble in history. And all we're doing is saying, well, we'll just borrow more to get out of it. That is stupid. That just doesn't make sense. And it is. It is like taking more of a drug to keep from coming down on the high. That never, ever, ever works out well. You have to get off the drug at some point, and that takes a period of austerity. And every major debt bubble in history has been followed by periods of 10 years or more of austerity. And that's what it takes. But if you go through that like we did in the 30s, and unlike the Japanese that did not go through that in the 90s when their bubble burst, then you come out of it stronger than ever because you restructure a lot of debt. Companies consolidate and get more efficient. You know, innovations emerge. Every time there's a big challenge, major inflation in the 70s or major deflation in the 30s, we get breakthrough innovations, you know, like the computer and then the personal computer or automobiles and electricity or jet engines. I mean, major things come out of this. But if you don't let the economy rebalance and restructure, if you don't let the bubbles burst financially, if you don't let debt deleverage, then you don't get there. Japan's been in chapter two of the book. We call it the coma economy. Now, for 23 years, they've had pretty much zero growth, zero inflation. They've gone nowhere because they haven't let their debt deleverage. They should have gone through winter by the early 2000s and be in a whole new spring growth season like we did from the 1930s and the 40s and 50s. But they haven't come out of it because they didn't let the economy rebalance. They chose QE. We'll just keep the economy from crashing, keep the banks from going down, keep companies from failing. But the price for that is you never, ever grow again. That's too big a price. I'd rather have the crisis restructure debt, force innovation and lower, you know, greater efficiency in businesses, and turn around and boom again. We came screaming out of the 1930s and basically have boomed ever since. That was a big reset. It was very painful, but it was extremely productive in innovation and productivity after that.
You know, it amazes me. We've got Japan sitting out there that I think is on QE 6 or 8 or some number, but we can just take a look at them, what they've done. And I know on your graphs, I went to your demographic school, and we're about 11 years behind on that chart. And we can see our future ahead of us. Don't any of these smart guys that are running this country take a look at that and say, wow, we've got a problem?
No, they don't. They don't. Economists don't study demographics. They don't think it matters that much. The only demographics they understand is a growing, aging population against a slowing workforce. That they get. Other than that, they don't get crap. They don't think that. I mean, I tell people, do you know the difference between a 19-year-old that contributes zero to the economy and costs a lot of money on average because they haven't entered the workforce on average yet, and a 46-year-old that's earning and spending $60,000 a year? It's a huge difference. How can you not take that into account, especially when you have such a large generation like the baby boom entering the workforce in the 70s and then peaking in spending in the last decade? I mean, this is massive, and nobody looks at it. And the same thing, Japan's already had their real estate and major stock bubble peak already, and that peaked when their baby boom was peaking, just like, you know, we've been looking for in the United States. And they did this over a decade before the U.S. and Europe. We should learn from what happens when the bubble bursts, and we should learn from their mistakes, and that is endless QE will keep you from going into a deep debt crisis like the 1930s, but it will also keep you from ever recovering from this coma economy. And so it's not good policy. The Japanese have already proven that. Well, but nobody studies the Japanese. Everybody thinks, oh, the Japanese were an anomaly. No, every major developed country is going to go through the same baby boom crash, debt, you know, pressures and stuff. And we can either choose to live on QE endlessly until we die and never come out of this, or we can basically restructure debt and get on with life.
Well, you know, Harry, I built my practice in the 80s with your book, The Great Boom Ahead. And we did seminars on that constantly, and about, you know, demographics and stuff. And it's amazing to me how just now, the last couple of years, people like Charles Schwab and Vanguard funds and some of the big major institutions now are finally starting to say, hey, demographics matter. Now, some of the guys on CNBC, which I won't mention anybody's name, still don't. They think it's a religion. You have to believe in demographics. I about died laughing when I heard him say, I don't believe in demographics. It's a fact.
I know.
It's not a belief.
I'm like, are you an idiot? Demographics is the one projectable thing in our economy. We know exactly when people enter the workforce on average, exactly when they buy their first home, when they have their kids, when they buy their largest home, when they peak in spending, when they peak in investment, when they peak in debt. Why wouldn't you want to project those trends into the future? It's a piece of cake. You know, a kid could do it, a 10-year-old kid could do it with a calculator. Our best indicators, we have more complex indicators, the more short-term we get, but our long-term indicators are incredibly simple. We can project workforce growth, and that correlates with inflation. We can project spendings of new generations, and that correlates with the booms and busts. And it's just like a 46-year lag on the birth index. I mean, how complicated is that for when people peak in spending? I mean, this is simple stuff. Economists don't get it because they don't want to get it. They went to Yale or whatever, and they didn't teach. Real economists don't believe in demographics. That's something for wussy sociologists and marketers to study. They just won't get it.
Yeah,
in spite of facts. They're going to die because they won't change. They're Luddites. And economists are the worst profession I've ever seen, the least innovation I've ever seen of any profession. Robert Shiller's the only guy that came up with a new view of housing over time, why it only grows with inflation, doesn't grow with earnings or the economy. And he's come up with this new way to measure valuations on stocks. He's contributed two major tools. Well, I've contributed dozens of major tools. Economists just don't pick up on it. They're not innovative. They just believe what they believe. They do what they've already done. And pretty much what they tell people, and this is why I stopped taking economics. It was my first major, but I gave up. They basically say, nobody can predict the future past the next election. I'm like, well, then you are useless and you're clueless because you can. We projected the peak of the boom in the United States in 1989, 20 20 years before it happened. Don't tell me you can't project trends. Demographics is projectable. Scientists can predict all types of stuff zillions of years out in the future. They know when the next ice age is going to hit. You know, they know all types of stuff. They can tell you where the tides are going to peak at any beach, anywhere in the world, down to the minute. Scientists know you can project stuff. I read more science books than I do. Economics is a total waste, from my view.
Well, you know, that's one of the things I think that a lot of people who get to hear you on TV and get to see you on TV, if they really listen to it and they don't try to hear what the guy that's interviewing you is trying to interject himself into it, they listen to what you're saying. What you're saying is very common sense because, like, in one of your books, you talk about that at 42 years old is when you buy the most potato chips in your life.
Yeah,
well,
exactly.
If you owned a potato chip country or you owned a potato farm, it would be kind of important to know how many people are going to hit age 42 and going to be buying a lot of potato chips.
Well, that same cycle, it's a calorie cycle that driven by kids that have the highest calorie intake at 14 and they're born to the average parent when they're 28 for the baby boom. That same cycle would drive grocery stores, which is much bigger than potato chips and generally calorie foods in general. So, you know, you would know anywhere in this country where the demographics are favoring grocery stores and when they're slowing. And we're past that peak for grocery stores in the United States.
Well, yeah, because as an aging population that we have, they're going to be buying less and less food.
Yeah. You know, the biggest thing I have, Chuck, is that, again, I did two 3-day seminars in Sydney and Brisbane, Australia, where I literally spent probably 6 hours presenting and another couple hours in Q&A. I really got to give people everything and go over everything. And believe me, after that much time, people don't walk away thinking, well, maybe Harry's got something or not, maybe he's right or not. It's just clear. We cover it from macro to micro, you know, from overall spending down to potato chips. And we look at technology cycles, and we look at commodity cycles. We look at geopolitical cycles. And these things correlate. I mean, the geopolitical cycle we got, I only discovered that when I over-forecast the Dow in the 2000s boom. You know, the geopolitical cycles turn adverse about every 18 years. I mean, well, every 36 years for 18 years. And 2001 to 2019 started with the tech wreck, then 9/11, then the Iraqi war, then Afghanistan war, then the Arab Spring and Syria, and now Russia and Ukraine. It's just one thing after the next. This is not good for risk in the world, and it's not good for stock markets. Stock markets are valued less in these times, and that's one reason that you know, the bubbles we've had here, as bubbly as they are, weren't as bubbly as tech stocks were in the 90s when everything was favorable, demographics, technology cycles, and geopolitical. From 1983 to 2000, nothing went wrong in the world except the 100-hour war with Saddam Hussein when he went in Kuwait. 100 hours, it was over. You know, no, we didn't try to occupy the country, we didn't get an extended war, so we're in one of those periods, and so don't expect geopolitical cycles to get better. They're only going to get worse into late 2019 or so. And so we have, you know, over 30 years determined what really makes a difference in the economy, because you can't study everything. There's endless cycles and endless factors, and that's why economists get so confused. You know, we've got a hierarchy of demographic, geopolitical, commodity, and decennial 10-year boom-bust cycles that tell you largely where the economy is going decades in advance. And we've got an inflation indicator that tells you decades in advance. And inflation, we're only going to see deflation trends into the early 2020s. We're only going to see commodity prices going down into early 2020s. These are very reliable cycles that I have now charted out and correlate back hundreds of years when you can go back that far. And they correlate even more in this century when we've gotten, you know, more modern and more intelligent and have better statistics. So people shouldn't sit there saying, oh, I have no idea. I can tell you when your kids or grandkids are likely to experience another depression like we're about to go through. I can tell you that. It's a long way away. It'll be when they're old like us. But, I mean, I can tell you that today, just like a scientist can project, maybe give or take 5,000 years, when the next ice age is going to hit, and that's going to be about 80,000 years from now. And then who cares about that? But the fact that they can predict that, and that ice ages occur on such predictable cycles, is the important point. We can predict the most important things about the economy decades in advance. And so you should know this, and you should be planning for your kids and your business and your retirement around these predictable cycles, and not sitting there listening to CNBC wondering, well, this person says this and this person says that and blah, blah, blah. No, there is no this and that long term. There's clear cycles, and you can understand them, and they're not complicated.
Well, Harry, we really appreciate your time. I know you've got a busy schedule, and we appreciate your time you spend with us. And we are going to talk as soon as we let you go. We're going to talk about your book, how people can order it and get one by calling us. I have books that I've been giving to clients and giving to callers. We're also going to talk about your free newsletter, and we're going to be talking about that right afterwards. But we appreciate your time, and look forward to talking to you soon, and I'll be seeing you soon too as well.
Yeah. Thanks, Chuck, again. I enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you, Harry. We appreciate the time. Well, listen, you're listening to Investing Simplified. If you've been listening to the show, I got to tell you, you got to get Harry's book, The Demographic Cliff, How to Survive and Prosper During the Great Deflation. We're going to talk about that for between 2014 and 19. We'll be right back on Investing Simplified.
Price Financial Group, Wealth Management.
The time to stop working is approaching, or maybe it's already arrived. CDs and money markets are paying only fractions of a point. How secure do you feel about retiring right now? Call Chuck Price. He's located right here in Portland, and he can show you how to increase your Social Security up to 67% using specific program rules and the file and suspend strategy. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or are close to retiring, and he focuses on how to never run out of money during retirement. Do this today. Schedule a free 20-minute retirement plan phone consultation or schedule an appointment with Chuck himself. Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. Chuck Price at Price Financial Group Wealth Management. On the web at pfgwm.com. Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepson, estate planning attorney and partner of the Warren Allen Law Firm, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Here's Carl Jepson.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified. This is Carl Jepson, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about some, I guess, more micro wisdom as opposed to the macro wisdom of Harry Dent.
Well, you know you're a powerful hitter when you get to follow Harry Dent each time.
Well, at least I'm not the warm-up band for him, so
yeah.
At least that's not it. But anyway, and I don't anticipate that I will take nearly as long as Harry or have anything quite as important to say. But he was giving some sort of basic principles, which I sort of gleaned out of his thing, which was basically, you know, protect your assets now, work longer, and, kind of avoid the stock market for a while. And, those are kind of little bits of wisdom. It's kind of like, you know, buy low and sell high. It's one of those kinds of, which we might all call a proverb almost, you know. And so that's what I'm going to talk about. Over the years in my practice, I've seen various repeating cycles, shall we say, of things that do happen. And so I've come up with a list of what I call legal proverbs. And, you know, some of them may be a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but most all of them have a little bit of, at least a little bit of truthfulness to them, or a little bit of wisdom. And I think many people who've been involved with estate planning or lawyering or anything like that will kind of perceive some of the, hopefully, the nuggets of truth that these have. And if you have questions or anything, give us a call here about anything legal, 503-417-7626 or 800-990-0750. And you can join our conversation. You can comment on Harry Dent, or you can, and if you do call in, you're going to be lucky to get the Demographic Cliff book from Harry Dent. And I've been reading the book, and it's really interesting. It's one of those things you kind of have to read a little bit at a time, because it's very full of stuff. But it is kind of interesting.
It's not a quick read.
No, it's not a quick read. But anyway, so legal proverbs. Number one, if you have a dispute with your neighbor and he's truly crazy, move. Now, anybody who's ever had a neighbor dispute, you know what this is like. And I will tell you, in fact, I actually have had sort of almost an informal rule for some years, which is my legal assistant is supposed to not let me take neighbor disputes. Not because we can't do them, but because they tend to accelerate to, you know, I mean, it's like taking over Crimea, you know. I mean, it gets really worse, and people get entrenched, and it becomes, you know, nothing gets more heated than a neighbor dispute, except possibly a divorce. And I don't do those either. So anyway, but that's just where that little bit of wisdom comes from. Number two, this is one I like a lot. Drafting your own living trust is like learning how to swim from a book. When you think about that, you know, if you just read about how to do the breaststroke or anything like that and jumped in the deep end of the pool, you might have a problem. And that's the kind of same thing that people do when they try to draft their own legal documents. And I can tell you this, that it, even though it's going to cost you a little more upfront to get it done right, it's going to cost you a lot less than fixing it if it goes wrong. And it's kind of like, you know, pay me now, pay me later. It's the kind of thing that happens. It, quite frankly, I've found that when I have had someone who has had a poorly done trust or will or whatever it is, it is much harder to fix it, and it's more expensive and time consuming, and sometimes they're not even fixable. So that's an important thing. Number three, there are three fundamental laws, rules of contract law. Get it in writing, and get it in writing. The oral contract does exist, but it's not a good thing to rely on. So anything that's of any importance, you need to get a written agreement that is carefully drafted. Number four, protecting a foolish child's inheritance with a trust punishes your trustee and doesn't solve the problem. Spend the money while you're alive. So in other words, sometimes people want to fix their kid with a trust. They want to make their child become responsible when they're not. And usually, if they're not going to get the money until they're, you know, in their 40s or 50s, and they're still terribly irresponsible, it makes very little sense to try to, you know, restrict their access to the money. I'm not saying cut them out. I'm just saying don't make the trustee make the hard decisions for them and then have to fight with the beneficiary who resents it horribly. At that point in time, you know, a lot of times the cost is in the emotional cost and the cost to the family. And if the beneficiary gets all his money and he gets to use it unwisely, well, you know, then he suffers the consequences. But nonetheless, the trustee doesn't have to have, you know, serious problems with their sibling and have to live with that sort of situation and try to make the tough decisions on behalf of an ungrateful beneficiary. We've actually seen that. Chuck and I have seen it on a number of occasions. One in which the beneficiary was so bad that he threatened to blow up his trustee sister, and he actually could have carried out that threat because he'd been a munitions expert in the Army, and we ultimately had to get a restraining order against this guy. But anyway, so long story short, number five. When you go into business, the first thing you need to do is make a plan to get out. This is one of the things that a lot of people don't think about. They start to go into a business, and I see this particularly if you got, you know, two or three guys that or women who are putting together a business together, and they get along fine now, but they don't anticipate the possibility that things aren't going to work out, and then all of a sudden they've got a mess. So it's a good idea to have an exit strategy. Number six, not even lawyers can avoid taxes. And what this really means is that when almost every transaction, every business, every investment has some kind of tax aspect to it. So that's where the CPA comes in. Kevin, if you're listening, you know what I mean. It means that getting that good advice in advance will really help you avoid some of the pitfalls, the tax pitfalls. And quite frankly, it's complex enough that a lot of times the simplest seemingly simplest transaction may result in some really serious tax consequence, and you walk right into it and never even know. So the main thing there is to realize, we once had a professor who said, every transaction you do has a tax consequence. And I think that's a very good thing to remember when you think about, you know, whatever you're doing. So get some tax advice. Number seven, if you want to prevent litigation regarding your estate plan, don't make anybody mad. And, you know, this comes from, a lot of times people will, you know, they'll have the family dynamic where they're saying, you know, my daughter, my son has just been ignoring me or doesn't want to come to dinner with us or whatever. And so I'm giving them less, or I'm cutting them out. Well, that's all fine and good, except when you die, you're dead and you don't have to listen to them, but their siblings do. And so, you know, just think of those things. Think of the consequences to your siblings when you do something like that. So just a thought. Number eight, if your children are broke, you might want to consider selecting someone else as your trustee. And the reason for that, of course, is, you know, the temptation, if they have really difficult financial circumstances for whatever reason, the temptation of having the checkbook open to them is a big one, and it can lead to all sorts of trouble. So, you know, that's just not a good idea. Number nine, when a man dies rich, chances are it's too late for him to enjoy his money. And just the thought here, of course, is that sometimes we work so hard to accumulate some money and to enjoy it, but then we don't enjoy it. We accumulate it and kind of hoard it and hold on to it and cling to it and spend, you know, a million hours in the office, and we don't use it for good purposes or for our own enjoyment. And so just a thought, try to live a little. And, try to, help live a balanced life sometimes is more helpful. Most people aren't remembered for their money. They're remembered for what they meant to somebody else when they die.
You'll probably live longer, too, if you do enjoy it.
Well, that's hopefully the idea.
Yep. It looks like we've got got about 7 minutes to go. So if you do have a question and you want to call, you need to give a call right now, 503-417-7626 or 800-990-0750. You know, Carl, I think the clients who live a full life, who have interests other than just money or just other than, one thing, enjoy a fuller life and do enjoy life a lot more.
Oh, I think so too. And it's, a lot of people I know who have substantial assets are really well-rounded people, and they've done well, they work hard, but they also, they are involved in their church, in their community, and their, in their families. They do a lot of things, and they make a great contribution to society beyond just the income that they produce. So I'm very much in favor of that.
Well, there's a song by Tim McGraw. It says, "Live like you were dying." Have you heard that song before?
Yeah, I have.
And
yes.
It talks about that he became a friend that a friend would want to be. And you have a total different perspective on life sometimes.
Absolutely. Well, I actually have two more to go, and I'll quit. 10. Now, this is a very favorite of mine. Litigate and prosper applies only to lawyers. And
That's very true.
Yeah, I mean,
that's very true.
The fact of the matter here is that I have found that litigation is expensive. But it is one of those things that if I'm involved in it, because it's very, very time consuming, it makes me a lot of money.
And a judge gets paid well too for it.
Absolutely. But for the clients, I don't know, most clients, even if they win big, they come out of it not feeling all that great. And so I think, and I don't mean to disparage litigators, and sometimes it's necessary. Sometimes you have to do it. But all I'm saying is if there are ways to avoid it, or if you can, a lot of times people stubbornly go forward on a righteous path and then just refusing to make any kind of compromise because they believe they don't have to. And that may be true, but the cost of getting there can be pretty high. And more often than not, just the emotional cost of not having to go through the trouble is worth an awful lot. So, it's a good idea to try to settle your lawsuits as quickly as possible. And number 11, another one of my favorites. When you consider that the primary function of lawyers is to prevent the rest of us from shooting each other over disputes, one can never say there are too many lawyers.
Well said from a lawyer.
So anyway, justifying our own existence, I suppose. Yeah. But anyway, hopefully you found some interest or humor, or at least maybe a tiny bit of wisdom in those. And that's Carl's comment.
Well, Carl, we the first 40 minutes of the show, we had Harry Dent, which was really great because Harry can really get going. And one thing I've been talking about on this show for some time now is to make sure that you have your serious money in a preservation of a principal portfolio and something that's going to protect you. And if you don't have, I just a word of wise out there to the investors, you need to have a strategy. If you don't have one, you need to sit down with your advisor and find out what their strategy is. And you should have a strategy to preserve some of your money to make sure you live to fight another day. And because with what I believe what Harry Dent says, and I think we do have a time coming where we're going to have a very tough period of 5 to 7 years, there's going to be a lot of great opportunity to cash in on that if you have the money. if you get caught in the downswing and you lose 40 to 50%, you're not going to have the money to do what you want to do with it. So you got to have a strategy. If you don't have one, you better get one. And so, Carl, somebody wants to get a hold of you, how would they do it?
I can be reached at 503-255-8795 or at warrenallen.com on the web.
And I can be reached at pfgwm.com. And also, I do want to mention, if you do want to get Harry Dent's Survive and Prosper newsletter, you can sign up at harrydent.com. That's harrydent.com. You can also sign up on my website at pfgwm.com and sign up for his newsletter. Also, we want to mention that Kevin Stange, our partner in crime here on the show, is out doing taxes, which is, I'm glad he is because I'm one of his clients. So I'm happy that he's doing those kind of things. But we will be back next week. And hopefully, if you do have any questions, don't hesitate to either get a hold of Carl or Kevin or myself. And there is no foolish question when it comes to your money, your estate, or your taxes. Would you agree?
Absolutely.
Well, listen, we're I think we got a couple more minutes, though. I tried to send a note here to my engineer, but for some reason my little machine here isn't working. I've got about 8:55, so I think we got a little bit of time left here. We're going to find out. Not enough time for a call, however. And so we got about 1 minute, and they've got to play the ads that we didn't get to play when Harry Dent was on. So we're going to be checking out.
Have a great weekend.
Have a great weekend, and we'll be back next Saturday with Investing Simplified.
Price Financial Group, Wealth Management. Price Financial Group.